Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems. On the island of Maui, they've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com, that's MauiNuiVenison.com, and use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore. Hey guys, before we jump into this render, I want to tell you about Meat Eater Gives. From December 6th through December 13th, 10% of all sale orders over $50 on the Meat Eater store website will be donated to organizations handpicked by the team. The organization that I'm going to donate my portion to is Sportsman's Alliance. These guys are guarding the gate. They're protecting our rights as hunters, and that is often a thankless job, and I want to say thanks to Sportsman's Alliance. So if you use the code CLAY on your Meat Eater store purchase over $50, that money will go to them. Also, you'll be able to see my top 10 picks for gift ideas on the Meat Eater store, which they got all kind of stuff. They got tethered saddles, they got game bags, they got knives, they got t-shirts, and soon we're going to have some Bear Grease merch. That's coming. Check this out. Meat Eater Gives. Merry Christmas.
All right, I just want you guys to know that this is like a little insider info here. Because you guys are a whole new crew, you're going to be heavily scrutinized by the regular render people, okay? So every word you say is going to be evaluated. It's going to be talked about amongst the group. So who's usually on the render is my wife, Misty Newcomb. Sharp as a tack will pin you to the wall if you get a fact wrong. Brent Reeves, witty as they come.
He's loud.
Daniel Roop. I mean, that guy, you don't want to mess with him. So I'm not trying to scare you. Just trying to tell you, you're going to be scrutinized because we have a new group. Welcome to the Bear Grease Render, guys.
Thank you.
So we have a totally new crew. This has only happened one other time. So welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Man, I can't wait to introduce all you guys. So we are in Northwest Arkansas, in the midst of the worst whitetail deer hunt that probably any of us have ever had.
It's accurate.
And it's been in the mid-70s every day for Arkansas, which is very hot. And we've been hunting. Tomorrow will be our fifth day of hunting. And we've killed one doe and one cottontail rabbit. We won't go into the details of who killed these animals. But maybe later we will. Now, let me introduce my guest. To my left, Jared Larson of Onyx. Jared.
It's an honor to be here, Clay. I'm
welcome, man.
I'm stoked to be on the Bear Grease Render, and I'm excited about talking about the Folsom site. And,
yeah.
As tough as the hunting has been this week, me and my cameraman Wyatt Cole were talking when we crawled out of our stand this morning. We've barely seen a deer, and this has been one of the funnest weeks in deer camp just because of the camaraderie and the entertainment value that the boys have brought to camp.
Yeah. You know what? Justin and I kind of had the same conversation on the way out of the woods after basically seeing nothing today. I just said, man, it sure seems like we've had a good time. Shouldn't we be having a bad time because we have such a bad hunt?
Wyatt this morning was like, dude, it's already Thursday. And I was like, whoa, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Which usually doesn't happen when you sit for 4 days in a row without seeing deer.
Yeah, it's tough. So, Jared, what do you – so guys, okay, introductions go slow, okay? So we're going to take our time here. This is important. People are important, Rusty Johnson. Jared, what do you do for Onyx?
So I am the whitetail marketing manager, for lack of a better term, at Onyx.
Tell us what Onyx is. I mean, most people would know, but there's some that wouldn't.
Yep. So Onyx, I work on the Onyx Hunt app team, and we build a GPS mapping app that turns your smartphone into a functional GPS, whether you have service, whether you don't have service. Our bread and butter is private land ownership data. But it's used for a plethora of different game species, from hunting elk in Washington to squirrels in West Virginia. If you like to hunt, heck, if you just like to get outside, there is going to be value for you in the Onyx Hunt app. If nothing else, it keeps you from getting lost.
Yeah. Hey, okay, Rusty, do you ever feel like we're getting punked by the cell phone companies and maybe even by these guys? When we don't have cell service and they can still, our phones are still GPSs?
I know, right?
I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's one of my favorite features is the offline.
No kidding.
Yeah. And we have a lot
of areas
here.
How does that work, Jared?
Well, you know, you punch in two lines of code to some software engineering and it's done.
And your phone's a GPS.
That easy, yeah.
Used to, GPS was like a big deal. You had to go like buy your own GPS and anymore. Not so. Onyx, man. Nah, yeah. Good to have you guys. I'm going to go out of order, and I'm going to introduce Zach Sandow. Zach, you work for Onyx, too.
Welcome
to the Bear Grease Render.
Yes, thank you. I'm excited. I've been listening to these since the first one.
Hey, he
I'm
really does.
On it.
He pulls out. Man, okay, if you listen to the Bear Grease podcast, Clay Newcomb knows it real quick. I could go through and I could tell each one of you guys how many times you've listened to it and how many times you haven't.
We're going
to
do that.
Based upon, like, you know how they're tracking. You know, these companies track people's data.
Not Onyx. We don't do any tracking.
I track my friends' data on how much they've listened to the Bear Grease podcast. And Zach Sandow listens to it because he was pulling up little facts from the Boone podcast like weeks ago.
Hmm.
He was like, man, that when Dan Boone did that, I was like, you really listen, don't you?
I do.
And he was like, yeah. So.
Honestly, Zach, for me, like, it's when it first came out, we work with you anyways, but the storytelling of it was sweet. And I do a lot of drives. Hunting season, like when I'm driving across state, it's the perfect thing to listen to, a good mix up from the traditional podcast, especially in the hunting industry. I mean, it was easy. Like, yeah. I just had them, I'd download four or five of them and listen to them on a full trip there and back. And so it was always great. But yeah, no, I'm pumped. I'm pumped to talk about this one. Myself, I've worked at Onyx for 6 years now.
Okay.
I manage the hunt team, work with the marketing team, and then the folks we have. A you know, awesome team and our company as well. You know, we have our hunt product, that's our baby, that's what got us started, but now we have an off-road product, and then we also have backcountry product. So
yeah,
we've grown quite a bit since Jared and I first started. There was 32 people when I started, and what was it, like 50?
60. Yeah.
60 when Jared started, and we're much, much bigger than that now.
Yeah.
Four and a half and six years later. So it's been really cool.
And now
to watch.
You're originally from Montana.
Yep. I was born and raised in Missoula, Montana, so
Missoula,
where
Montana.
Our home office is.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
And now, Jared, you're from Wisconsin.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Whitetails, you know?
Whitetails. So, to your left, Jared, is my buddy, Justin Michaud. Justin, welcome to the Bear Grease Render, man.
Thank you, buddy. I feel like I've been on this just by hanging in the tree with you.
Yeah.
We've had a podcast going for 5 days already.
I talked Justin's ear off when we hung together. Just nonstop chatterbox.
I learn a lot from you.
Man, so Justin and I, Justin went to Canada with me this year and filmed. And then he's been with me this whole week and filmed. We didn't know each other before that, though.
Nope.
So back in September when we first met, and we've had a great time. Justin is extremely talented and good at what he does. Let me just tell you, if you're needing a, I better not say this. People from other companies might listen to this. If you're going on a whitetail deer
you're
hunt,
you're already fighting Mark. Remember?
I know,
so
Mark.
Better...
Me and Mark Kenyon fight over Justin when we're tree stand whitetail hunting because he's the man. So no, Justin's a really good photographer, really good videographer, really good to have hanging in a tree with you, and a good whitetail hunter too. So I go to him for advice. What should we do, Justin? Hadn't worked too much this week, but
yeah, you know, scent control.
So scent control. That's right. That's right.
No, I'm kidding.
You're from New York.
Yes, not originally. Originally from South Carolina. So I feel like with these accents that are flying around here, I feel a little bit like I'm at home. But yeah.
Because all the Yankee accents?
No. No, you guys, the Arkansas boys.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Ooh. It feels like South Carolina. You guys got that same southern flair.
Okay.
And I was just at the gas station, and they had fried chicken by the register. So I knew I was in the right place. But yeah, I got a lot of kids. Not a lot. Three.
Three kids.
They're all great.
To your left, to Justin's left, my old buddy, Rusty Johnson.
Hey, Clay.
How's it going, man?
It is going good. I'm glad to be here. Finally sharing an account with Clay Newcomb.
Ah, man, Rusty and I have known each other since 2007 when I killed a deer and you were an official Pope and Young scorer.
Yeah.
Looked you up. However, we found Pope and Young scores back then. Probably on the internet.
Yep.
And it was probably in like a Yellow Pages book. It was probably like that long
ago. That was a long time ago.
Yeah. But it's been fun hunting with you this week.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a joy. We've had a blast.
Yeah.
Yep.
What do you think about all this? This has been like ridiculous, hasn't it?
Oh man, this is probably the hottest and probably hardest hunt I've ever had this time of year here in Arkansas. I mean, it's so unusual.
I can't. I don't know that we've broke records, but it would surprise me if we didn't.
Yeah,
76 degrees on September or December 2nd.
Unreal.
So we're gonna go around here in a minute and talk about Rusty. But to your left, we got a couple of guys that don't have headsets that are here. We'll go back to them. But to your left is your son, Rustin Johnson.
What's going on?
How you doing, man?
I'm doing really good.
Trail cam Sam.
When I met Rustin, he was just a little dude.
I was still chubby, but I was little.
Yeah.
Fun size.
How tall are you, Rustin?
6'3". Or if I'm wearing boots, 6'4".
6'3", yeah. And you're not exactly petite as a six three man.
No, I'm anywhere between 300 and 400 pounds. Depends on what time of year if I'm in hibernation or not.
Oh man. Well, you guys are so fun to watch. Father and son team. How old are you?
I'm 24. Yeah.
And your dad turned 50 just a few days ago at camp.
Just turned 50.
It's been so
Everyone
fun.
Thinks we're brothers though, because he looks young for his age.
He does. Yeah. He does.
He looks good.
Clean living, man. We'll talk about Rusty's. We want to get Hunter to talk a little bit about Rusty's hunting style. But so the other guy that's here is Hunter Rood. Hunter, you're where are you from?
I'm from Southeast Minnesota.
Southeast Minnesota. And you've been hunting with Rusty Johnson all week. Give us what are you going to tell people about Rusty when you go back home next week? When you talk about his whitetail hunting, his eccentricities, all these things. Describe him to us.
He loves hunting whitetails more than anybody on this earth. Like, there's no argument against it. And he spends more time in a tree than anybody. Okay. I mean, his straight-up tactic is get a picture of a buck and then just go sit in the tree and wait for him to come back. It's real simple. Just spend as many hours in a tree as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Even if it's 3 hours before sunrise. I mean,
yeah, okay. What time have y'all been waking up?
We've been waking up at he wakes up at like, I don't know, 2:45.
Yeah, I've been getting up about 2:45.
And I come downstairs and he's sitting in the kitchen fully dressed, waiting at
3:45.
We were joking this morning. Hunter was real proud of himself because on day three, he felt like he'd woke up before Rusty and was going to be ready. Because the first day, Rusty said, "We're truck is rolling out at 4 o'clock. And the guys, like, woke up Hunter at like 3:57.
It was 4 o'clock.
It was 4 o'clock.
It was 4 o'clock.
And I was going out the door at 4:03.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then so a couple days later, he's like, okay, I've been trained by Rusty now. I'm going to beat Rusty down the stairs. And he walks in, he flips on the lights, and there's Rusty sitting, waiting.
Sitting in the dark in the corner.
Like, tapping his foot very impatiently, like, come on, like, looking at his watch. Like, trucks running, everything's ready to go. It's just like, man, this dude loves it. And so, can't get enough.
And you've been sitting long days?
Yeah, we've been doing all day sits, and I mean, like, well, we get down and switch trees, but I mean, you're still in the woods all day, but it'll be like 75 degrees, and this dude's like, one might just walk by at noon, you know? Even though it's 75 degrees, you know, he might get thirsty.
Hey, me and Justin, it was actually Justin's idea. So today, so we have this group text thread going, you know, and turns out I'm kind of in the lead on like the point system we have going here. Yeah. I wasn't going to mention who killed the deer and the rabbit. Yeah. But Justin, so we decided we were going to get down at like 10 o'clock this morning. And what I was going to say about Justin, we're coming back to Rusty, but I'm going to talk about Justin. Justin, every single day at about 8:30, starts talking about sausage gravy and biscuits.
Oh, man. Brutal.
And he'll start like glaring into my eyes and kind of lean forward and go, man, some flaky biscuits and some sausage gravy.
Eggs. Buttery eggs.
Mm. And he sees it works on me. I kind of start to soften up a little bit. And so we go, we get down, and I said, well, maybe it was my idea.
It was your idea. You were about to throw me under the bus, and I was going to stay there, but go ahead.
And I said, I tell you what, let's do. Let's go to the town over here 20 miles, me, you, and Zach, because Zach was hunting with us. Let's get a big country breakfast and get back to camp about, you know, 12:30, 1 o'clock. Everybody's going to be wondering where we're at. And what were you going to say, Justin?
Well, we've been hitting it hard.
Well, you were gonna say anything could happen.
Yeah, anything could happen. You got to be out there.
But he was mocking Rusty. What Rusty would say. So yeah. It was really funny. We laughed.
We didn't get our breakfast though.
I don't think that food trick would work on my dad Rusty.
Oh no,
he doesn't eat like at all during deer season. Uh-huh. He loses a bunch of weight.
No, the first day I sat with him, I was monitoring that, and he ate a Hershey's candy bar with nuts in it, and that's like his go-to.
Uh-huh.
Drank one bottle of water. At noon, he ate a granola bar, and that was it. All day sit.
All day.
Meanwhile, I'm on like 3,000 calories.
You're king of the snacks.
Okay, and there was also a rumor going around the camp the first day that like in an all-day sit, like sitting across from you, eye to eye, you're filming him. He said like 10 words. Y'all kind of warmed up later in the week.
Yeah, we did. Like, day three, we talked about beaver trapping. We got really close after that. But that was like two minutes max. I mean, we're in there to kill a deer, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't kill a deer if you're talking.
Yeah. Well, that's not necessarily true.
That's strange that the, you know.
It's strange that, yeah, the kind of the team Nukem Mishu is winning.
I mean, we've been passing bucks the last couple days.
Okay. Do you pass them if they're at 130 yards?
I'm not sure that's an archery pass.
How about the other two that were at about 10?
Okay, you know, great point.
You were saying Brown, it's down. I mean, Rusty has high standards.
Okay,
we're working.
Now, what I did learn about Rusty on this trip, you get like anxiety before a hunt, like excitement, anxiety.
Absolutely.
Talk to us about that. Can I help you with that?
Well. When I wake up, I mean, I'm so worked. I don't get much sleep, you know, when I'm hunting like this. And
right. When
I wake up in the morning, I have this gag. I mean, I just start gagging because I've got so much excitement and I'm so ready to go. I mean, it just, it's the anxiety. I mean, it just, I'm so excited about it.
How often would you say you feel that much excitement / anxiety about a whitetail hunt?
Every day that I go.
I can validate it. I hear the puking every time. See, I'm still like asleep, but he wakes me up about to leave and he's puking or gagging.
This is after four days of seeing
this
nothing.
Is normal, Rusty.
I've done this for years.
He gets wound up.
Really?
I mean, I love it so much that it just gets to me. I don't know what it is.
Jared, what do you think about this?
It blows my mind. Like, I mean, I love whitetail hunting, but Rusty getting up like a full solid 2 hours before everybody else in camp. I mean, the fact that he sits in the dark drinking coffee, waiting for his cameraman.
No, he's not drinking coffee.
Like, he is beyond next level, and I will echo Hunter's sentiment that throw some names out there that might like whitetail deer hunting as much as Rusty Johnson, and let's put them into camp together. Let's see.
My money's on Rusty.
Same.
Like, whatever it is.
You Snapchatted me earlier this week, and you had the little temperature gauge on. It was 67, and it was like 1:25 p.m. You had the timestamp on there, and you said, we're sitting in a food plot waiting for one. And I just was dying because the rest of us were sitting in camp eating sandwiches. And
except for Clay and Justin, they were shock pouching one out.
That could be true. But Rusty was sitting on a food plot in 70
Justin?
Degrees
yeah,
December 1st, waiting on a big one.
We seen a big one, big spike.
Minnesota 11 point as you've
Northern Minnesota 11
point. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, we would have had a big one down, but I was in school for most of the time. This is the first day I've got to hunt.
Yeah.
So I've been hitting the books.
Yeah. Rustin is in law school.
Yeah.
Shock of the camp. I mean, I've known this for years, but you look like a lawyer.
I'm in my last year of law school. Yeah. I feel like I've been in school forever, but it's going.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
That is
almost awesome. To the finish line.
Good to know a guy like that, just in case you get in trouble, you know?
Get in a little trouble. Never know. Hey, the guy that I haven't introduced yet is Dalton. Dalton, how's it going, man?
Awesome, man. It's awesome to be here.
What do you
here.
Have to say about Rusty? You know Rusty about as well as anybody.
There's huge pros and cons to hunting with Rusty. And I think the guys have touched it pretty good. The only negative to hunting with Rusty is you start questioning how much you actually like to deer hunt. Like, that's the best way I can describe it. You think that you love hunting and you get hyped up. I sat with this guy for 13 days in Kansas. So we hunted 13 days. I think the first five, I don't know that we saw a deer. We hit it. Terrible timing. We had to make adjustments. And he's not joking. Every single morning that light came on at 2:30 in the morning. I don't set alarms when I stay with him anymore because the dry heaving wakes you up. It. The dry heaving will wake you up.
So this is verified by multiple sources.
Yeah, you don't even set an alarm.
You may want to get that checked out, buddy.
Yeah.
But that's incredible, though. I mean, it's December, right? It's December on one of the hardest hunts we've been on in years, and he's that way every single time.
And you killed a big buck. You've killed two good bucks this year.
I have, yeah. And
you killed a big one on public land.
I did.
Here,
I sure
just
did.
Like a week ago.
I'm excited about that one, but I'm also a little bit sad about it because that's a buck that Rustin was chasing. He hunted his butt off for that buck,
mm-hmm.
and I go in there in 2 days and knock him down. But sorry, Rustin.
But that's just what a dad has to do sometimes.
But yeah, it's a really nice. It's the biggest 8-point I've ever killed.
Yeah,
and I've killed some pretty good 8 points.
143.
Yeah. Ask him about his last biggest 8-point because I also had that one on camera and was hunting it, and then he goes in there and kills it. Too.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
last year.
That's nice. Yeah.
But I kind of set him up on it, so I was happy that he did it.
Yeah, you know, talking about Rusty liking the hunt so much. I identify with that because I remember before I got into the outdoor industry, I remember seeing all these guys in the outdoor industry and the problem with comparing people to people in an event where, like in sports, you know, you can compare like stats, you know, like how many points did he score? How many points did he score?
Yeah.
The guy that scored more points is better.
Yeah.
The problem with hunting is that it's not like that at all. Not even remotely like that, and nor is there any reason really why we would compare one hunter to another hunter, but we do
always
sometimes.
Human nature.
I remember when I was not in the outdoor industry at all, and I remember having a thought: I don't need to be the best hunter. I'll never be the best hunter at what I do. But I remember thinking, it is not possible to love hunting more than I love it.
Right.
And that validated me as a young man. I'm not saying the way I would express that would be different than you would, but I'm saying that is a valuable, that's a gift, man.
It is.
To be passionate about something.
It is.
Man, when I meet people that are not passionate about something, I don't understand that person.
Right.
To be passionate about something is a gift, man.
It is.
And as long as it doesn't control your life in a negative way. There are things that we can get into that like distort us and make us kind of screwed up as humans. I don't see that inside of your world. No. Rusty has a strong family. He's got a he's a great husband. He's a great father. And so, like, this hasn't messed you up. Because
no.
It messes people up.
It does.
Y'all know
it
what does. I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. you can take something to an extreme where, yeah, maybe the guy is like so, you know, so performance oriented that the rest of his life is a wreck. And or my whole hunting career, I've been interested in being as passionate as I could be and being the best that I could possibly be while maintaining balance inside of my life. Because I knew that for a white-tailed deer only means so much, but it means a ton when you have a big world mm-hmm. that it fits inside of kind of a context, if I could say it that way. And I see that with you and Rustin.
Yeah, and it was passed along from my
That's
dad.
That's right, yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your dad, I wish
he was
here.
My dad's one of the best hunters that I know.
Yeah.
I mean, he don't hunt much anymore. You know, he's getting older now, but, I mean, he is, I learned everything that I know from him, and yeah. he is one of the best hunters that I've ever seen.
And see, the first time I ever met you, you were with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized that you and your dad had a really strong relationship, and he was an official scorer, too, just like
yes.
you were.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know what we do on the Bear Grease Render. We have to, is there anything else we should cover?
Well, I think I want to go around and have you peg a number on how many Bear Grease episodes that we've all listened to.
Oh, sure.
Oh.
No problem.
Because, yeah, you said you were pretty dialed.
No problem.
Okay.
Okay.
You know that off the top of your head?
Should we set over-unders for each person?
This is totally going off just, this isn't like data that I have like behind the scenes. This is just me interacting with you and...
This is your intuition.
I would say Jared has probably listened to 70% of them. Justin's listened to 5. Rusty's listened to about...
5% or 5 podcasts?
5 total episodes. Rusty's listened to 1.
Probably.
Dalton's listened to 3. Rustin has listened to probably 80% of them.
Maybe.
In the ballpark?
Ballpark. Maybe a little bit lower. I'm a busy guy.
I'd say... Okay, so it's all off.
Yeah, well, I'm in law school, got United Outdoors and Fireside Apparel.
Your recollection of the ones you did worked. And Zach, you probably listened to, Justin's showing me his deal.
Do you see this?
These are your top 3.
Yeah.
So you've listened to more than 5?
Yes.
are you offended?
You underestimated him.
Are you offended?
He's filming offended. Your hunt tomorrow.
And Zach, how many have you listened to, Zach?
I don't know. I was trying to think of that. I think you have what?
30 episodes.
30 episodes. I would say I'm over 20 for sure.
Okay.
I don't know where I'm
Good.
At
so
from
like,
there.
You know, like 70, 60.
Yeah, I can't say so, I've listened to all of them.
Okay, now tell me how I did.
You were probably, I'm probably about 50%. If there's 30 episodes, I've probably been at 15, 20 in that realm. You were in the realm. I was impressed.
Okay. Yeah. I was off on Justin. Sorry, 10. Justin.
I did 10.
Nah.
But it's
Rusty.
Double.
You were exactly correct, and I listened to it today. But after listening to it, I liked it, and I'm going to start listening to them.
Okay.
It's
okay.
Really interesting.
Good. Dalton,
I think I'm exactly 3 actually. The very
first. Wow. How many did I say?
You said 3.
Okay.
I think it's exactly 3.
Okay.
I don't know. You should give a little spiel about, I mean, I think the hunt can be summed up.
Rusty
hadn't seen much for the first 3 days. The last 2 days, he's been in the game.
Oh,
in the game
I
with
am,
a great buck.
I am in the game. I am in the game
Talk
for sure.
To us.
Yeah. Hey, those first 2 or 3 days were terrible. Terrible. But then we moved over here to this new area. And
let's first Clay Newcomb here just wrangling.
Yeah.
Private permission.
Yeah.
To change the course of the hunt.
We need to start from the beginning. We came here to hunt public land in Arkansas. Bow hunt public land. Mm-hmm. Starting on November 29th.
We got to give credit to Rusty Dalton and Rustin from United Outdoors for spending, I don't know how many hours in boot miles.
Thousands.
To scout and have some ideas laid out for us. But Mother Nature came in.
This same week last year, it was on fire.
I remember that.
It was.
You were texting me from the tree stand.
Yeah.
And what was cool about this for me is this is a place that I used to hunt, but had not hunted it probably since 2005. So that's kind of the overarching thing. And then we got permission on a big piece of property over here just for the days we're here. Just kind of a random deal. We ran into somebody. They happened to have a big piece of property, and they happened to let all of us bow hunt it. And it's a really good piece of property. I mean, a fantastic piece.
Yeah.
Just the weather and timing is still really tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Rusty is on one. Tell us your story, Dan.
Well, I got lucky. You know, we kind of all dispersed and kind of spread out.
And Clay,
you know,
kind of told you where to go.
And Clay dropped me a dropped me a pin. And so that's where me and Hunter went. I got lucky.
I thought I was gar-holding.
Yeah, it was the gar hole.
That's kind of what I had in the back of my mind. He was gar holing me. But anyway, it turned out really good. I mean, we saw a lot of deer. We saw a really nice 8-point come out, grunted him into the base of the tree. We decided to let him go.
He was dead by everybody else.
We saw we saw a nice little 6-point spike. We saw a lot of does, over 20 does. I lost count of how many does we saw. So we noticed where they come out of the woods, and right at last light, Hunter said, "Here comes a deer down the fence line." He said, "I think it's a small buck." So I put my binoculars up. And I said, "No." I said, "That's a shooter." So, I mean, we were running out of light really fast. And he got in to about 15 yards, and he smelled us, and he started snorting. But he wasn't moving anywhere. He would just stomp his foot, and he would snort. And I just need him to take a couple steps.
Gotta love these private land mature bucks, man.
Yeah. Two steps is all I needed for him to, you know, to get in an opening. And he stood there. We were losing light. He finally took those two steps. I come to full draw. I could not see my pin in the peep sight. So it was game over at that time. So I just let my draw down, and we just sat there, and he finally eased off. So we made another play on him tonight, and we again misjudged where he was going to come out. And we saw him again, and he got within 50 yards, and I actually drawed on him. And again, it was late, low light. I couldn't see my pin and my peep. I don't think I would have took that shot anyway. I mean, 40 is about my max nowadays. When I was younger, I might have shot a little further. But so he eased off, so we got one more day to make another play on him, and I feel confident. If he does what he did today, then we might have a shot at him. Yeah. I'm hoping. Keep my fingers crossed.
Yeah. You know, we're all rooting for you, man. We need some excitement around here.
I believe this deer would bring some excitement to the camp.
Yes,
he's a really good buck.
I think a spike will bring some excitement to this camp.
I think another rabbit tomorrow would bring a little excitement.
I think you're
camp.
Right.
Although that's not an overly true statement. The excitement level has never wavered. I mean, there's been positivity and
that's the best group of guys.
A lot of chatter going on. So it would just be some nice icing on the cake to come through in the fourth quarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's be careful not to start any rumors. Deer hunting is terrible. Turkey hunting is terrible. Might as well go to Missouri.
Yeah.
I'm kind of starting to hunt Oklahoma, so Oklahoma hunting is terrible too, so don't go there. Justin, what do you think of this hunting? You hunted all over the country, really?
It's tough, man. I mean, again, I feel like you can't get past the barrier of it being 75 degrees in December. I mean, you told me on the phone when we first talked about this trip, this is going to be tough. You know, I didn't imagine it being like this, but
yeah.
I mean, it was cool to go in. You know, we got a mile back in from the truck into some serious terrain. Coming, you know, from New York and making judgments on where to sit based on like food and things like that. It's just like, there's no food here. How these deer survive, I have no clue.
It took me 3 days to find deer poop.
They don't poop here either.
Yeah.
Rusty took the only video of the only deer pooping in the county.
You have
so.
To eat to poop. I've been intrigued at, like, because I'll say to you, I'm like, I mean, we're looking at the map. I'm like, where's the food? Like, why would these deer get up from one spot? Like, they should just lay there and die. There's no
food. There's just give up. Yeah. Not now.
Besides, for no food, there's like baseball and softball sized rocks underneath like 4 inches of leaves.
Yeah. It's like, rock piles, man.
Ankle busters. Yeah. So if they move to try to find food, they break their ankles. So it sucks to be a deer here. Yeah. And that's probably why we're not
and
seeing
then Rusty
any.
Johnson is creeping right. around in every
if,
tree yeah, day
you
and
decide,
night.
If you decide to get up, Rusty will kill you.
Rusty's got so many trail cameras out, he knows when every deer in this county
stands up
poops and stands up. Yeah. Oh, man.
Well, while we're sitting here, you know, with our shirts hanging off in like swimsuit weather, I'm getting photos of deer back home. So as soon as we can wrap this up.
Yeah, it's just like, man, I'm really wasting my time in this tree stand.
I see actual food on these cameras of deer eating. No, it's good. I mean, but like I was saying, we went back in a mile from the truck, and obviously at home too, you have to pick spots based on terrain and movement. And like, you know, we sat and again, it felt like Nowheresville for two nights or two sits. Saw deer the first night. They were just out of range. And then the next morning we sat, and man, the only deer we saw ended up on your back.
Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years, made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives, and the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released. So head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people.
O'Reilly Auto Parts are in the business of keeping your car on the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts offer friendly, helpful service and the parts knowledge you need for all your maintenance and repairs. If you're confused about what part you need, like what wipers are going to be the best, what replacement headlights are going to be the best, go into O'Reilly and talk to the people that work there, because they're great and they're super friendly, and they'll get you squared away where you walk out knowing you got the right thing. They've got thousands of parts and accessories in stock, either in-store or online, so you never have to worry if you're in a jam. Do you need your windshield wipers replaced? You need a brake light fixed? You need some quick service? They'll help you find the right part or point you to the nearest local repair shop for help. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts are your one-stop shop for all things auto do-it-yourself, and you can find what you need in-store or online. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today or visit us at OReillyAuto.com/meateater. That's OReillyAuto.com/meateater. Pay attention here, because this is a hell of a good service. It's called the Wellness Company. Picture this, okay? You wake up, you got a scratchy throat, you're all congested, you got a runny nose, you got a cough, whatever. And you weigh your options, like you tough it out, get sick, take time off work, try to get a doctor's appointment sometime in the next few months, wait 2 hours at urgent care and sit in a room full of six sick folks, or you open your medical emergency kit. You match your symptoms to the doctor recommended prescription and you start on the right meds right away. These medical emergency kits, not a first aid kit, all right? It comes with doctor prescribed meds to treat over 39 medical issues. So, on hand, strong antibiotics for infections of all types. Plus, a doctor's easy guide so you know exactly what to take and when. No waiting to see the doctor, no waiting at the pharmacy. It's all in there. Every home should have at least one medical emergency kit. Order yours online in minutes. Your kit will be rushed to your door. Get 15% off at twc.health/meateater, but you got to use the promo code meateater. That's promo code meateater, okay, at twc.health/meateater.
I want to talk about that. Rusty, I don't know if I told you the whole situation with that doe. Man, let me say as well, I was absolutely thrilled to go back in where we did and kill that deer. I hunted back in there when I was in college. I think about that spot to this day. A fall doesn't go by where I don't think about that spot back there where I took Justin.
Really?
Yeah, because it was when I cut my teeth bow hunting over here. I mean, I left Gary Newcomb's camp, Camp Newcomb, and was flushed out on my own, you know. And I found that spot on a topo map before Onyx when we actually went to the store and bought a big 3x3 topo map. But I hadn't been back there. I just moved. I just have done other stuff, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so to go back in there and even just to kill a doe, thrilled. Oh. I'm serious. That's the highlight of my season. I've killed three pretty good bucks. I told Justin this. There's a one of my arrows is still in a tree over there somewhere because I missed a deer up there at like 40 yards. And my arrow stuck in a tree, and I just left it there for the anthropologist in 10,000 years.
Huh.
When I was in school years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Segue.
Yeah. And, that's going to be our segue. But I want to talk about this doe real quick. This doe came in. We were up just under 30 feet.
103 feet.
We were real high.
Yeah.
Because that's the way you beat a deer's nose, boys. You get up real high.
Hang out
and
with the birds.
This doe passed all the way around us and actually dropped down into the kind of head of this hollow. And I was hanging as absolutely far to the left as you could in a tree saddle.
Trusting
it. I've got my feet like, you know, just like on the side of my platform and I'm just like hanging off. And this deer steps out to 30 yards and I knew it because I'd ranged openings and I just knew it was about 30 yards. The deer, it's thick. I drew before she came into the opening. I mean, it was just perfect. And she got into the opening, bah, grunted at her. There was one vine about half the size of your pinky that was running up about 3 feet in front of her, right over the vitals, and I chose to send it. Because I knew
choice.
That if it deflected, like it was close enough to her that it wasn't going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
If that vine had been 15 feet away, it would have been different. Shot and in my mind, I just hit it right where I was aiming, 30 yards. And so now the deer is probably 40 feet below me, though, because I'm 30 feet from the ground, and the deer is at least 10 feet below the base of the tree. Am I right?
Yep.
So it's way down there. Shoot. In my mind, I just see it just go right where I wanted. But still, it's a long shot. I couldn't really tell. The deer mule kicks, runs out there, stops 50 yards away, and I think it's just going to start tumbling down the hill. It stops, it turns, and it starts walking. And I go, oh, man. And it gets down, it just walks out of sight, and then we hear a deer start blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the deer that I've shot isn't blowing, but in your mind, you're thinking,
it's not
deer
good.
I just shot, blow it. And Justin, I even said, did I miss that deer? And Justin was like, I could have swore I heard you hit it. And I said, I could have swore I saw me hit it with my eyes.
Yeah.
And then, but then there's a big log right behind this doe. And I think maybe I went right under that doe and it hit that log and just thudded and it sounded like I hit her.
Nothing like what goes through your mind after releasing an arrow.
Yeah. Like
second guesses, third guesses,
two and a half minutes,
seventh guesses.
Creep in. Yep.
And so we sat up there for 20 minutes. I get down. I walk over to the arrow. Well, first of all, from the tree stand, we're glassing the arrow. And the arrow has no blood on it that we can tell. And I'm in my mind thinking, yeah. I just tin ring this deer and this arrow is not adding up. I get down, walk over to it, pick up the arrow. And I'm telling you, that arrow was almost clean and it had stomach content on it, very little blood and white hair. So I go back up and report to Justin and say, not good, buddy. And we sat up in the tree for 2 hours and I'm like kind of in the dumps, just like, man, I just gut shot this deer. This is, you know, we're going to track this deer all day. We're over a mile from the truck. We finally get down, start tracking it. Spotty blood.
Looked like liver blood.
Dark liver blood. Not very much liver blood. Stomach content and little specks of blood. Trail it to the log where we saw it. Turns downhill. We get about 10 yards from where I saw it. And there's a deer laying there dead. And I walk down there and I absolutely tin ring that deer. I hit it. I counted ribs. I hit it 4 ribs into the rib cage. The deer's quartering away from me. 1, 2, 3, 4 ribs in.
Mm-hmm.
Entry hole. The arrow exited about 3 inches behind the front shoulder in the lower 1/3 of the cavity. Entered right here.
Wow.
Came out right here. Necropsy showed liver and double lung.
Wow.
Crazy.
And
she walked away.
And she walked away, and that arrow was covered in... It was expandable head, and it clipped.
Oh, Clay.
She was blowing...
Don't tell me that.
She was blowing, like, stomach contents out of her hole.
But it was... The entry hole had stomach contents. Anyway, it was just wild. I mean, everything about... Every single factor that would tell me gut shot, but my eyes told me it was a 10 ring. Anyway, it's a good shot.
That was a good shot.
So it worked.
Well, and it's a dang good thing that Clay did 10 ring that thing, because I was in charge of the food plan. And I just planned in a night of venison, because all I heard was about this on fire week in December.
Yeah.
And boy, we just about went hungry one night.
Yeah.
By on fire, we were talking about the temperatures, not the
Live and learn with you Southern boys.
Yeah. Okay. Well, back to my my arrow that is lodged in an oak tree back on that ridge on public land that anthropologists will dig up. The point of the Bear Grylls Render is we need to talk about this, the Folsom Part 2 podcast. Killing bison with stone points. Jared, what did you think? What stood out to you?
Well, all right, so the one thing that stood out to me is the number that I think I heard was 32 bison
found.
And bison antiquus?
Bison antiquus.
And, you know, it sounded like they harvested these bison with some type of atlatl or spear throwing.
We don't know.
What really stands out to me is I've butchered some elk. I've butchered some deer. I cannot imagine the amount of time and effort it took to butcher 32 1,000-pound animals with stones. Those people had to be there for days cutting up bison meat. Like, they maybe just lived there for a month.
They may have set up camp.
Yeah.
Like, that part to me was just like, man, I cannot imagine that workload.
Yeah. That's a good point. And what we don't know is how many people there were.
Well, and, you know, there was some speculation. I think it was you and Steve going back and forth that these people, it was not a populous area as far as human beings anywhere on this continent at that point in time, to the point that you guys were saying that it likely wouldn't have been uncommon for you not to see anyone that you weren't related to for your entire lifetime.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in my mind, it was like, okay, what, like 15 people, 20 people killed 32 bison? Oof.
Yeah.
If I was up there with an atlatl, I'd have been like, all right, guys, we got to let a few of these things run away. Like, I ain't butchering for 6 months.
Well, hey, that's a good... How many got away, though?
You tell me.
That's one thing that I was wondering. How many was the herd actually?
Right.
I mean, how many was actually in the herd?
Yeah.
And I can't remember in there, did he explain why there were no bulls? I mean.
It was just that's a good point. It was a cow-calf herd. So there just weren't, that time of the year, breeding was done. And bison segregate like that, and there'll be bachelor groups.
Just like whitetails, Rusty. Bachelor groups, hanging out, doe groups.
So it was just a cow-calf herd. It was in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a question. So you say it's a cow-calf herd. Is there any knowledge or speculation around whether they valued the horns or antlers off of maybe the males, and they might have taken it with them?
Well... there were not males killed at the Folsom site in that pile, because they accounted for
the other bones,
the skulls of the females and calves.
Pelvis.
You know, so it wasn't like there were unaccounted for. And they were able to tell that it was all females. And so, and they left all the skulls.
And because they said that there's no value to them, right? So they wouldn't carry them because they're too heavy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got the select cuts and then got out of there.
Yeah, yeah. It would be interesting to know how many got away, because undoubtedly you would think some would have gotten away.
For sure.
Yeah.
What's crazy is, like, I mean, you shot that doe. She ran 50, 60 yards. Like, how are they doing this that they're just piled up right there?
That's the mystery, like, man.
It would be hard to move a big animal. Yeah, I mean,
but
bison,
I mean, like,
are huge.
If you hit those, you would think that they would run. Like, and
they all died in a spot about as big as this living room.
Wow. They all figured they died right there? Because, I mean, weren't they found in a creek bed?
Well, but also, like, the topography that they talked about plays into that.
Yeah.
Being at a box canyon up at the top. Yeah. But I think it is interesting with that. For one, there's a couple things going. I'll take a step back in a second, but how they knew it was in the fall, I think that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's so straightforward, but yeah. When he said it, it's like, wow.
I asked him, I thought, why didn't I think of that? I should have known that. But it was really interesting.
But with the Box Canyon, I thought it was interesting because immediately I thought, like, yeah, they're going to disperse. It's crazy to think they drug them all to one area to take care of them. We knew that they took select cuts. So if you're going to do that, you could just do them where the animals are, get what you need and go, so you'd think it'd be more dispersed. So I think the topography definitely plays into that, especially when you get into the tactics from Steve to, who was it, Dr. Meltzer was Dr. the other Meltzer. One? I think they both could be valid.
Now Kyle Bell is the one.
Kyle Bell.
So Meltzer and Steve, you know, had the same idea that they were herded in there and all killed.
Well, wasn't Meltzer's that they were coming in there on their own free will for
That was Kyle Bell.
That was Kyle Bell. Without knowing the area, it's tough to say. I think both could happen. So Steve thought that they were herded in and they got stuck at the top of this Box Canyon, no place to escape. Kyle Bell thought they were going there freely. Bison are going to do what they want, and they were going in there for some sort of mineral. And then, you know, knowing that they're going to go in there, it's a perfect ambush opportunity. Hey,
this wasn't on the podcast, but this is what the Bear Grease Render is all about. The manager of the Crowfoot Ranch, really sharp guy named Seth, he thinks there was a mineral in there too. And I mean,
and Clay, what do you think? We never heard an opinion from you.
Man, I got to go with the experts. Dr. Meltzer has literally devoted like a massive part of his career to studying this exact thing. I mean, he studied a lot of other stuff too, but I mean, he literally wrote a textbook. Like the book that he wrote is like an academic textbook. Hmm. I mean, it's like, it's not like a nonfiction, like fun read, you know, like it's like a textbook, man. So I just got to believe the guy has more data points than he can say in a 5-minute section on my podcast. And we talked a whole lot more. I mean, I talked to him for hours.
Yeah.
And we've now heard him speak on the podcast for like 21 minutes. Mm-hmm. Sure. That's what it boiled down to with him. Yeah. So, you know, there's stuff you just got to take out. That being said, these other guys who, this Seth, this ranch manager, he's running cattle all day. He's on that land all day. He knows that farm. He knows that place.
Watch us, how similar and ungulates.
He didn't think he could push him in there. Huh. And then Kyle, he's got a convincing little soundbite there.
Yeah.
He's like, I've been on 200 bison kills.
I've messed
with bison. But Steve's point, I think, is pretty a counter to that, which is so strong, which was these bison literally may have never seen a bipedal human before.
Sure.
A triumph.
They could have walked up to these things and like scratched them behind the ears before they killed them. I mean, I'm exaggerating.
Yeah.
But these aren't domesticated bison like we would have today.
For sure.
So potentially the behavior of these animals, and undoubtedly humans have, we know it from whitetail hunting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so clear. Human predation changes animal behavior.
Absolutely.
So potentially they could have been herded.
Yeah.
And I think they probably were herded in there.
Do we know what the major predation source was at that time?
You know, that's a good question. I'd have to look it up, but there were some wild predators back then, man.
Yeah, probably some mean stuff.
There were. I'm not sure if the dire wolves, they probably weren't around at that time. Definitely some simulation of a modern gray wolf. Yeah. But, I mean, these bison antiquus came out of a time of predation of, like, massive jaguars that are, like, three times as big, American cheetahs, American lions, saber-toothed cats.
Yeah.
But I think those were deeper into history. It really is fascinating.
So, and the other thing that's kind of shocking to me, at least from what I gleaned from your podcast, was they found the bison, you know, remains. They found some Folsom points, but there really wasn't any other artifacts that were found. You know, nothing other that suggests that they made camp there for a while they dealt with these bison, or that they were in the area for any significant period of time.
Right.
So like that was kind of shocking to me.
So probably on part three, you'll hear David Meltzer talk more about that, because part three, I asked him, I said, who were these people? Like, what do we know about these people? I mean, these were humans. They were like us. They had emotions. They had feelings. They were just like us, but they used flint rocks to clack together to make fire. and they made stone points out of chert that they found.
They're a little grittier than us.
So I asked him, you know, who are these people? And that's when he began to talk about how we do not know where they camped. And that's his biggest frustration, he told me. As he said, we were there. We know so much about this site. He said, we cannot for the life of us find where they camped. Because they had to have camped close.
And there could have been remnants of a camp there. But over that long, what's going to be left is the stone. And not the baskets or the other things they might have had.
And I said this to Dr. Meltzer, and I'm not sure if it was an offensive question to ask an archaeologist, but I was like, I'm standing at the Folsom site, and you would have walked past it, and it looked like every other place. You wouldn't have thought something special happened here.
Yeah.
Looked like every other place. And by now, you know, the second excavation by Meltzer was done, and, you know, it was over 20 years ago, so it just looked like a drainage, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm standing there, and I ask the guys I'm with, I'm like, how do we know there's not something incredible 12 feet under the ground right there?
Yeah.
Nobody ever dug there. We don't. They literally dug up a spot about from this living room wall to probably the kitchen door over there, which is about
that
30
small?
Feet. I'm telling
you. That whole box canyon hasn't been excavated?
Way.
No.
What?
I could, you know, my measurements might be wrong, but I'm telling you could have shot a recurve bow.
Wow.
Any side of that to the other one, it could have.
I would have thought something this important, they would have went way beyond the bounds.
Yeah, why? The backhoe would have been in there.
Well, no, you got to be careful because every time you excavate, you destroy.
That's okay. And this is when you learn about archaeology, which I'm doing now. You realize how it's like surgery. Yeah. I mean, it's like saying, there's something wrong with this guy. Why don't you just go in and fix it? Well, it's not like, I mean, these guys are like taking months and months to excavate like a small area. I mean, they're like removing. I mean, so it's.
I'd have been an excavator like back in George's time. Yeah. Shave off the bison skull to fit it in the box.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You got to catalog all kind of data points too before you can even remove the item.
Right.
I mean, you said that the paleontologist got there first. And was concerned with the bones and everything.
That's right.
But then later the archaeologists came and they said that a lot of what the original excavation did, like, took no regard to humans.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were worried about the bones.
Yeah.
And so they weren't that concerned about anything else. And at the time they excavated it, you know, we didn't have the technology that we do now with radiocarbon dating and I couldn't get into all the detail of what Meltzer studied. I mean, it was like wildly deep stuff about the sedimentation, the sediment layers. They were able to take those 10,000-year-old bones and understand how long they were in the sun before they were covered with silt.
Wow. That's crazy.
Because the decay, you know how a bone, like if you had a deer bone out, you know, somewhere, wherever the sun was hitting, it would turn white.
Exactly.
Wherever it was touching the dirt, it would maintain its natural color. And they felt like with pretty quickly, like within a couple of years, that thing was silted over. Mm. And that's the reason it was preserved for 10,000 years.
And then it was only uncovered once in recent times, like within the past 100.
What was it, 70 years before Meltzer did? Was the first time, or
that was the excavation?
Yeah, the
and now they removed everything that they didn't leave anything in the ground.
Yeah,
on purpose. George McJunkin found a small section of bones.
Yeah,
yeah.
As, you know, imagine a 32 bison killed right here, and there's a drainage right here. The flood pushed the cut bank of that drainage. You know, imagine 3 or 4 feet this way.
Yeah,
exposed these bones enough for George to be like, those are cool. Somebody needs to come down here and check this out.
Yeah.
You know, and then he dies. Nobody comes. Finally, they come. And then this guy named Carl Schwaheim, who was a friend of George's, the museum hired him. He wasn't even an archaeologist. He was just a dude.
And, all about who you know.
Yeah. And they hired him to get them a bison antiquus skull. Because by that time, they'd been like, hey, that's bison antiquus. That's pretty cool. We need one of those. They hired Carl. Carl goes in there, starts digging. Carl finds at Folsom Point, which at the time wasn't a Folsom Point. He just finds a stone point. It's like, dudes, I found a sweet stone point.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool in Meltzer's book. He has Carl Schwaheim's handwritten notes. because Carl was instructed somehow to write notes of what he found every day.
This is late 1800s?
No, this would have been 1926 and 27, okay. Something like that. And Carl, it was a pretty good artist, and he drew in his notes a picture of the Folsom Point that he found, and it looks just like it.
Huh. That's cool.
So how big are these?
They're not real big, man. The big ones are like 3 inches long, probably that long.
Is the stone that they're made out of, is that native to exactly right there, or did it come from somewhere they made somewhere else?
One Bear Grease podcast, and he didn't even listen to that one that good. we talked about it on the podcast, Rusty. They got that stone from Texas, 150 miles away in Texas.
The panhandle, so right?
He did listen.
Okay, you jogged my memory.
But then Steve saying that they were finding, or you could find Folsom Points throughout the West?
That's right. That's
up
correct.
Up north, far north.
Absolutely.
So those people roamed.
Well,
at least shared
technology. It wouldn't have been necessarily those people, and the stone wouldn't have come from there. But what he was describing was that technology, and we're calling technology the design of a point, was clearly connected to people that were connected to one another. Like, if you made a Folsom Point, and what to me is so neat from a human perspective is that Folsom Point represents so much more than just a stone point to kill an animal. If you're in Montana and I'm in New Mexico, and we make the same stone point, I guarantee you we share the same value system. We probably share the same understanding of who God is. We probably share the same value system of how we hunt, how we manage the land, how we raise our kids.
Very similarly.
I mean, there's just so much more that's transferred. And what's so fascinating, and Steve did such a cool job of bringing it out, is that the stone point isn't necessarily... I mean, of all the things that could have been left, the stone point just happens to be made of a material that is basically just lasts.
Yeah.
And so everything else is gone. We have a stone point.
It's a shame that that's all we have, because there's just like so many questions left unanswered, but it also makes it kind of fun.
Oh, it's sweet. Because
you get to dream up your own scenario.
Well, yeah, it's the symbology of it. Like, we're looking at just a stone point and essentially writing a narrative, well, trying to put together historical context, but then building a narrative and trying to get, you know, an inference from this. And I was thinking about it. What, you know, you're joking about your arrow and, you know, someone to find 10,000 years, but like, let's take the arrow out of it. What do we have that's that symbolic? Because, like, as you're saying, those people are connected from that one point. What is something today that if someone found 10,000 years, would it even last, for one?
Yeah.
Would it make it there? But then what is something that's that significant? Like, and I was trying to think about it. I don't know if there is something like that.
Why are people shooting expandable broadheads?
I was wondering what the cutting diameter was on that Folsom Point compared to your Mega Meat. You know? How effective are we hunting here?
They find that expandable and they go, these guys were real
chumps.
Low IQ.
Neanderthals went extinct. Yeah.
Hey, actually, Rusty, I have three expandables and four blade fixed heads in my quiver.
Oh.
And I've shot way more fixed blades over the last 15 years than expandables.
I'm proud of you.
I know you did.
No need to be proud. I just kill stuff and it dies. what's so awesome, it's the mystery of this that is what makes it so unique. How did they kill these bison? We don't know. We wouldn't need, I thought Steve's, I mean, this is what Steve's good at, is like the idea that this was just a snapshot of time.
Yeah.
And trying to understand if this was a big deal or if it wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was this another day?
Was this just a normal day?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we need to go get our meat harvest for the next 3 weeks. Let's go get them.
Yeah. Were they talking about it for years?
Or did they talk about it for the rest of their
lives? This is the pictograph on every wall in New Mexico, is this bison hunt.
Incredible.
Yeah, it makes me think, like, how much of that got, like, when that flood came, how much of that stuff is
gone?
400 or 500 yards down further, you know?
Yeah.
So many of those, you know, bones.
That brings up a good question of mine that I had, or my major question to the pivotal point is, there's so many different weather events and different climate changes in the past 10,000 years. I'm wondering if some kind of weather event maybe artificially moved them together, the site, or maybe the erosion and then the covering, the erosion, how many cycles of that occurred over 10,000 years and how that may have affected the site. There's just a lot of questions that I have that I don't know if we'll ever know.
Well, see, we do. With the certainty that, with the highest level of scientific certainty, what they did when they went back 70 years later at Folsom.
Yeah.
If you read that textbook that Dr. Meltzer
I'm gonna
wrote
have to
between
now.
Your law books.
Yeah, yeah, between all the law books.
No, that's exactly what they went back to understand was they call it the paleogeography, which is what was the geography of the land, paleotopography, which is the geology of the land throughout the time period, because the geology's changed, but also the stratigraphy of the land, which is the stratification of it. They're able to basically tell by the deposition and the layers that this was not moved here by erosion, number one. And he went on and on, and I asked him, and I just clipped out these, you know, kind of highlight points. But I mean, what archaeologists do is determine that this happened culturally, not by the events of the natural world, like pushing this stuff together, because that could happen. Like, for example, you know, you could have a bison kill down 3 or 4 feet below the surface and have gophers digging holes and burrows down there and knocking a stone point from the surface down there and falling. Then you find a bison kill with a stone point there and you go, holy cow, you know, they're the same. Man, these boys make a living making sure that is not the case.
Yeah.
And there's a phrase they use called NC2, which means in place. I don't know. It's probably French for in place. Why we're using French words, I don't know. But basically, when they found that point, that Folsom point, in between two ribs, it wasn't stuck in a rib.
Yep.
I thought it was stuck. Purpose. Half the time I researched this, I thought they were saying it was stuck in a rib. And it was not. It was laid in between two ribs, and there's an iconic photo, and I'll put it on my Instagram, of two ribs. And you know how we've all probably found arrowheads in the ground when you just see half of it sticking up, and you're like, that's NC2.
Yeah.
And
I say it every time.
Yep. You know. And this was that. And then they found so many data points. I think they can understand the flaking on a point to understand how old it is. So like these bones are radiocarbon date 10,000 years. These flakes, you know, the stone points come back as being verified of being that old. So it's like everything there. The sediment was that. It's like no question.
So it's pretty settled.
It's 100% settled.
Wow. See, what I feel for Dr. Meltzer, though, is the various degrees of quality control throughout this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, he has a historical context and he can put this together, but he talked about, like, you know, the archaeologist from the paleontologist, but then even the way they mapped it.
Yeah.
It would be nice if he could just go and do it, like, you know, and get the full picture. Cause, like, how tough is that knowing someone? And I was thinking about that, like, people are trying to shoot holes saying that people haven't been around for 10,000 years, and it's like you could look and be like, that's not a credible source. He could have dropped that there, planted it, lied, whatever.
Yeah.
Man, it would be tough to try to figure this out knowing that folks who don't know as much as you do now, because we've progressed and we have better technology, kind of just went through and dug up some bones.
Yeah.
And you got to take that into account when you're trying to draw a conclusion from all this. Like,
it's like going to a crime scene that another detective has already ransacked.
Yes.
And trying to figure out
70 years later. Well,
but what, and just to clarify the whole conversation, Meltzer, it was long time ago established that this site was legitimate in 1928.
Yeah.
When those guys were like, the leading archaeologists in North America came and said, this is legit. There's no way to argue this. This is real. Humans killed bison antiquus.
Before the second excavation?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that was never in question when Meltzer went back.
Oh.
Meltzer went back to discover a whole lot of other questions that they had. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was never in question. But, and there's a bunch of Meltzer's textbook is about all the drama with that.
Yeah.
And it was really informative because you see, it's good. Like, archaeology is highly scrutinized. Like, they don't just, you don't just roll up and find a point and be like, yeah, we've been here for 300,000 years. And then everybody believes it.
Yeah.
Like, highly scrutinized. But what was interesting to me is that it was clear that it was highly influenced by human ego. I mean, he wrote about it. He was like, this guy didn't like this guy, and he was trying to discredit it for no good reason. And so there's that going on.
Yeah.
Like these leading archaeologists, you know, like trying to discredit someone because they didn't find it. Or,
yeah.
So there was some of that going on. But this was so clear cut that like everybody.
Huh.
The leading archaeologist at the time, I can't remember his last name. Maybe it was Brown. Within a week of him being at Folsom, he went out and he actually took one of the big full points. And he was a big enough wig that he was able to just say, I'm taking that with me.
Oh.
And he took it to all his lectures, and he said, man has been in North America for 10,000 years.
Don't lose that one.
And when he said that, it was like one was going to argue with this guy. But it was groundbreaking.
Yeah,
shattered. And what I'm going to talk about in podcast number 3 is it shattered people's idea of life on planet Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we thought humans had been in North America for 3,000 years, and all of a sudden we've been here for 10,000. It kind of, like, destabilized people.
So when you showed up to this site, you know, some places that you show up with historical significance or what have you, you just, like, there's an aura about it. You, like, get chills. It's kind of just like an experience to be there.
Yeah.
Was Folsom that way for you?
It was really neat being there. I can't say that... I mean, it was kind of an academic experience in some ways, just going there and seeing it and trying to understand what happened and then being there with the experts and stuff. But I'd be lying if I said it was sure. Totally like that for me.
Yep.
Now, when I come back and I really study it and kind of put it together afterwards, it is 100%. I wouldn't say that when I was there, it was like that.
Sure. Well, but when I asked him about that the other day, we were driving in the truck. He's like, it looked like that. And he pointed out the window. He said it could be, it doesn't look the same. It's not the way it was. So,
and that's true. It does not look like a box canyon anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It just looks like a drainage. And gotcha. By drainage, I mean like probably like 10 foot down. If you were standing in the bottom of it, the stream bed would be like 4 or 5 feet wide. And there'd
gotcha.
Be wow. banks what? Going up this way and this way. And it just kind of it kind of goes up just a little bit and then flattens out. But
I imagine like these plateau walls and no.
Huh. Yeah, I imagine
it was an indescript place.
Interesting. Wow.
But the Box Canyon, and I don't fully understand how they understood what it looked like back then. But
yeah.
they did. And yeah, you'd walk right past it. Not
well.
Think.
Eric Siegfried was drawing topo maps like 100 years before he came out with the Onyx Hunt app. Mm-hmm. Just didn't know about it. So
would say that again. That joke went right over my head.
Yeah. The Onyx founder. I was just joking that he had that Box Canyon mapped out. So that's how okay. I knew.
That was a nerdy Onyx joke. Got it.
Super yeah, nerdy Onyx joke.
There you go.
It also makes you wonder what's hiding under completely ordinary places, just all around us.
Totally.
I mean, that was what I said. How much of planet Earth has been explored by an archaeologist to this detail?
Yeah,
you know, very, very.
Slim. I like that it's that way. Yeah, I like it. I don't want to know everything.
Yeah,
I want there to be mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what is so hard for us to understand when you look back at human history and like the Folsom people, as we define the Folsom people. As being defined by this technology of the points that they used, they were around for about 1,000 years. The Folsom points were in fashion for 1,000 years. That seems like, when I say that, does that sound like a long time or a short time?
Insanely
sounds
long
like
time.
A long time. Yeah,
yeah.
Does it?
I'm sitting here. I was just thinking about like 10,000 years. That's not even really comprehensible for
right.
me.
Yes,
1,000 years is still like holy like. Still kind of incomprehensible.
So here's my point about how we live in this we live in the most bizarre human experience of humans that have ever lived on planet Earth.
I'd agree.
I mean, for 100 years, we've been using fossil fuels and driving trucks and cars, having electricity, having the technology to be able to have a conversation. This would have been supernatural stuff to a Folsom Hunter if we could say, there will be people that will listen to this conversation in the future. They would be like, what kind of witch doctor are you, man?
Yeah.
I mean, we live in such a bizarre human experience
yeah.
that we think that we're normal and that we think that this is normal. This is not normal to humans, at least if we look back at human history. And we are so stinking arrogant thinking, and I'm talking like as mankind, to think that we know everything, that everything is tame and that everything is discovered and that everything is understood.
Yeah.
Because science, the technology and science has just skyrocketed. You know, I mean, if human growth. Knowledge was on a graph,
yeah.
it would be a J curve, you know, starting about 200 years ago. And it would have got steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper the last 50 years.
And then you hit the internet and it like becomes a roller coaster and you do a 360.
It goes backwards.
Yeah.
yeah.
But there's so much we don't know and we'll never know. And there's so much yet to be discovered. I mean, this stuff like this, I think, is designed to keep us humble.
Yeah.
And yeah, they were using that point for 1,000 years, and I'd switch broadheads halfway through season sometimes.
The reign of the expandable head will be about 30 years.
Did you get to hold the Folsom Point?
Yeah. I did. I mean, not the ones they found.
Okay.
So that was something I asked Dr. Meltzer, is like, where is all this stuff?
Yeah.
Like, where are the bison? Where are the Folsom Points? And they're scattered around. You know, I mean, it was almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And things were way different back then when they excavated most of that stuff out. For instance, this bigwig archaeologist just carried a point with him, and they found it, as I understand it, they found it in his desk drawer after he died.
Wow.
Like, whenever he passed away. So, like, he had just, like, kept it in his, like, personal collection. And this is, like, a really incredible point that,
that
you know, should be in a museum.
Pivotal
to
human history.
And he's got it in his desk, you know, and they found it. So they still, some of the points are unaccounted for.
Hmm. Whoa, really?
So,
really?
And
I'm using one on this hunt right now.
Yeah.
Where did you get that fossil point?
No, Dr. Meltzer has in his textbook, they have a graphic that shows every single point they found, the front and the back. So there'll be two images, the front and the back. And I mean, so they documented every single one they found. And as I understand it, well, maybe they don't have documented the ones that were lost. I think they documented 16, but they said there was 20.
Okay.
And so there's four that are still, like, probably
in
the wash, you know. Somebody probably washed it.
Storage
wars, and wife threw it away.
Start buying those old storage units. Never know.
But but there are Folsom Points, real Folsom Points, in a lot of places. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to start to tell you like how many we have, but I mean, for sure, thousands. And you could find one today. We were at a farm in Nebraska a couple of weeks ago, and the farmer shows Steve Rennell and I his collection, and he's got half a Folsom Point that he found on his farm in Nebraska.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Huh. So, I mean, it's very uncommon, but at the same time,
They're around, yeah.
So when I was at the Folsom Museum, which if you ever go in that part of the world, you got to go there. It's really cool. It's just like this old time. It's not like, you know, it's the kind of museum you can go in and pick stuff up.
Mm. Oh, whoa.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Ooh.
So there's this case of Folsom Points, and I'm like, can I open that?
What?
And there it was like, sure. And I'm going to post I'll post a video at some point of me holding a Folsom Point. And, so they're around.
My kind of museum.
Yeah. Yeah, they're around. But we will nerd out on the technology of the Folsom Point on the fourth episode.
You guys do some kinetic energy testing and stuff?
Oh, man. I talked to as my understanding goes, the nation's leading expert on atlatls. He did his PhD on atlatls. And
YouTube
he went into detail on why they use that, why that technology, the Folsom Point, was so good.
I'm excited for that one.
Yeah, it's really neat.
I'm that one's very interesting to me because I mean I've shot enough critters with you know, a compound bow pulling 70 pounds that you get 3 inches of penetration when you hit a, you know, some bone inside of a whitetail.
Yeah.
Like the fact that these people were hand sharpening rocks, fixing them to a wooden arrow of some sort with what, like cattail fibers or something? I'm just making stuff up at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
And then hucking them, presumably, out of an atlatl, and they were able to kill 1,000-pound animals that way?
A bunch of them.
That is insanity to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Thus, I would like a YouTube demonstration with you in an atlatl in a Folsom Point.
That's a good idea. Much, there's quite a bit more to come. We're only halfway through the series, so there's two more full podcasts. And the things that the guys bring up next time, I think, are just as intriguing as this first one.
Huh.
What's interesting, too, is that this isn't the only one we have. I mean, there's other really unique sites. The Clovis site. The Clovis site was basically a similar thing, but it was a mammoth kill.
Wasn't really? That also in New Mexico?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was the same story. Except it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't the same story.
Mammoth is huge.
George McJunkin. What if George McJunkin had ridden his horse down there and found that too? Hey boys, there's another one down there about 400 miles. You might want to check it out. I believe it's a mammoth. What, George? Well, it's been super fun sharing camp with all you guys.
Yeah,
it really has.
Absolutely.
For having such a crummy week of deer hunting, we really have had a great time.
It's been a blast.
I hope some of the group text comes out on the Meteor episode because the people deserve to see it.
Well, hey, I hope Rusty wins this contest with a big. If you kill a big buck tomorrow, that beats a doe and a rabbit. Do y'all guys agree?
I think you'll agree.
I think you would just take the slight edge.
What you don't know is that me and Justin Michaud think that that buck might end up on our side of the road tomorrow.
Hey, well, wouldn't that be something?
It could.
There's a big old rub right behind our tree stand, and I can see.
I'm sure he's working that entire
area.
I
really think it was him. I mean, how many bucks are going to be rubbing on trees that big?
That's probably him.
It really is probably him. Now, whether he's there in the evening, I don't know. I hope he comes to you because I don't want to kill him.
Yeah, you do.
Well,
okay, you're right. I guarantee you would love to kill this bug.
No, well, it's been really fun sharing a camp with Jared and Zach. You know, I've known you guys, but this is the first time we really spent much time together. So it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. I've been looking forward to this hunt all year. And even though it's been tough hunting, yeah, as I said, it's going to be a highlight of my fall.
Good.
No doubt about it.
Good.
Yep.
Rustin, keep studying, man.
Oh, yeah. I got finals next week.
Ooh, that's awesome.
So, near here.
Nitty gritty.
Awesome. What's the game plan for the morning?
Yeah.
Give us the 60-second spiel on how you're going to kill this buck in the bottom of the night.
One day.
Okay. So.
Buckle up.
Rusty's gonna get sick and throw up.
I've made the decision. I'm going to hunt where we hunted this evening in the morning.
Against
your advice.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to slip in there. We'll probably stay in there a couple hours.
I know you're getting up early.
And yeah,
be up at 1 o'clock.
Yeah,
and then we'll come back here, and we're really going to think it over really hard, and then we're going to go back right in the middle of the day, and we're going to look at this spot really hard, and I'm going to pick me a tree. And I'm going to kill that buck.
All right.
Sounds like a plan.
It's pretty simple.
It's just that simple.
It's that simple.
Just taking us to class.
Good.
So I've been full draw on him twice. If I come to full draw the third time.
I just had a great idea. Fantastic idea.
What's that?
A decoy lowered out of your stand right at dark.
Ooh.
you wouldn't want to put a decoy out there throughout the whole day because it would mess up all the does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You need all the does to come by you. You've got a decoy. In the stand, you assemble it in the stand, put an eye hook right through its back, and then about 30 minutes before dark, you lower it to the ground right underneath your tree.
And then
buck decoy or doe decoy?
Buck decoy.
And then for the last 30 minutes.
So, hey, when that buck came out, he walked straight to
that 6 point.
That 6 point, and he nudged him.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't really get aggressive with him, but he just reached over and he nudged him.
Is this not the
We better get driving to the nearest.
That would work, Clay.
They will put my name in whitetail books. 50 years from now because of this.
10,000 years from now.
Lower the decoy out of the tree.
That will work.
Yeah.
And they'll find my point up on that mountain.
Rusty doesn't need to sleep
tonight
anyway.
And they'll be like, man, this guy, he must have, wow.
Get
he
driving
was beyond
to the,
his time.
Driving to the closest 24-hour Bass Pro, and you better go get you a decoy.
The one thing that they'll find 10,000 years from now that will survive is that buck with the J hook in the back.
The
they're going to make all kind of cultural assumptions. Like, man, these dudes are crazy.
Now, the ones that I'm going to make, the Newcomb lowerable decoys, you're going to have a stone point. That oh, you run boy. Your rope through that's stuck in the dude's back.
That'll last. Wow. There you go.
You better make the notch, you know, the bones. Books. You better, you know, fabricate some good stuff to stick that.
Yeah, just to mess with the anthropologist.
That Newcomb point in.
Oh, thanks a ton, guys.
It's been a pleasure.
This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Around New Year's, we get obsessed with how to change ourselves instead of just expanding on what we've already done right. Maybe you finally organized one part of your space and you want to tackle another. Or maybe you're taking your supplements every morning and now you actually want to eat breakfast. In the last year, I've been more diligent about going to the gym on a regimented schedule, and it's made a lot of difference in my life. Therapy helps you find your strengths so that you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greece today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Greece.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.